From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. After a year of masking up, physical distancing, and more, Governor Whitmer has set an end date to pandemic restrictions. She's hoping it'll boost business.
Now, as our economic recovery continues, our task is clear. Build back better.
Many businesses say they still need more clarity. Also, an ACLU report finds the Customs and Border Protection Agency is extending its reach far beyond the actual border.
Most people would think that the Border Patrol only operates at the border or in border towns and would be really shocked to find out that they actually live in a border zone.
Then we preview a new PBS documentary on the evolving political landscape of Hamtramck.
There's a lot to be learned both from Hamtramck's achievements, but also it sort of stumbles along the way with this idea of multiculturalism and diversity.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the program, we'll speak with the owner of a bar in Ypsilanti who's struggling to find people to come to work as the world opens back up out of pandemic.
What we need to get back up to full capacity is 10 to 15 employees, and those are hard to find right now.
That's later in the show. But first, let's talk about what Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced today, a new return to normal, realigning her VAC to normal plan with CDC recommendations. Whitmer announced she's lifting restrictions on capacity limits for outdoor gatherings and increasing capacity for indoor gatherings to 50% as of June 1st. Additionally, 1 month later, on the 1st of July, she will lift capacity restrictions for indoor gatherings as well.
On July 1, that is when we will take our final step. We will lift the broad mask and gatherings order and will no longer impose broad mitigation measures during the pandemic, unless, of course, unanticipated circumstances arise. We do not expect that to happen. We look at this as the last moment of these types of orders.
Many in Michigan's business communities applauded the decision, but also asked Governor Whitmer to go further and address workplace rules and restrictions through the Michigan Occupational Safety and Health Administration, better known as MIOSHA. Here with a view from one of those business communities is Brian Calley. He's president of the Small Business Association of Michigan, also former lieutenant governor of our state. Brian Calley, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, April. Great to be with you.
What sorts of employers would be receiving today's news with the greatest enthusiasm, do you think?
Well, there are certain industries that really haven't been able to operate in any meaningful capacity or way over the course of the last year. And that would be convention centers and wedding reception halls, any kind of gathering of people. And also, I think the fitness facilities, that's going to make a big difference for as well. But this is happening in tandem with a more broad allowance of office workers to come back to work. And there's a whole ecosystem of small businesses that exist to serve office workers and the traffic created by office workers in downtown areas. So I think that there are certain regions of our state that are about to take some big steps forward. And there are certain industries that have largely been static over the course of the last year, just waiting for their opportunity to begin their recovery.
Right. Brian, do you think that even with restrictions lifted, that some of your members might still plan on reduced capacity, some masks and distancing?
Well, there's two parts to this. So there's the public health orders that the governor addressed today, but the MIOSHA rules, the workplace safety rules, those have not yet been changed. So the employees of a business still, by and large, have to follow all the same rules as before, with the exception of the mask mandate if you're vaccinated, according to a statement that MIOSHA put out a couple of days ago. So this has created a lot of conflicts between the two different departments that are regulating the pandemic, and we're hopeful and, in fact, expectant. I think the governor hinted today that early next week we would see some updated MIOSHA rules, to try to align them better with the CDC guidance. And I think that will make a big, big difference in just the way that business owners and small businesses manage this pandemic.
So it seems like things might be a little bit strange for a while, or at least a little bit strained. And I'm wondering, how the conversations have been going about this? I know you've got a conference coming up. Do you think that you'll be talking to people as they think about the road forward, about how they might address ongoing safety concerns with or without changes from MIOSHA, or do you consider that conversation closed?
I think by and large, business owners feel that they understand what they need to do. And, you know, they know their customers, they know their employees, and they're going to manage accordingly to it. So I don't think that mitigation strategies are totally in the rearview mirror after the government orders go away. But I think they'll look very, very different. The businesses will be free to set up the mitigation strategies that fit the risk tolerances and the risk profile of the business itself and the activities that the employees are involved in. And that'll be a big step forward, because that really is how it normally works. So you have minimum standards or guidelines that exist in the regulations. But when it comes to the day-to-day management of businesses, most of these decisions would not be managed so tightly by government. And thankfully, we're getting into a phase here, a stage of this pandemic, where those types of management decisions will go back into the hands of the business owner themselves.
Brian, the governor's made it clear that we're entering a period of much more personal responsibility. At the same time, Michigan's track record in this way does not look especially sterling, especially during that last surge and flare-up, starting in the thumb, but really stretching to a lot of other communities. There is some evidence that people maybe do not adhere to the best health and safety practices when there is a flare-up. There have been a number of epidemiologists who expressed some surprise at the CDC recommendations. I mean, I know the governor is the governor, but do you really think that we have seen the last of public health restrictions for this year?
The one thing that I think that has been clear to me is that by keeping restrictions in place for such a prolonged period of time, I think has decreased the resiliency of people in terms of adherence to the rules and the guidelines. So I think as we move into the summer, where even without half of our population vaccinated last summer, the numbers went very, very low. So I think going into the summer saying, hey, instead of waiting until fall to loosen things up, we're going to do it at a time when the risk is lowest for our state anyway. And let's say something happens later on in the year. The fact that we had a break from all of these rules, I think will increase the likelihood that that if there is a need in the future for additional rules to come back, that people will be more willing to follow them. If we were to leave them in place all summer, even though there is really no indication that they're necessary, especially given our example from last year, I think that would do a big disservice for compliance overall with our population. It's people, this is the right time to take these actions, and then nobody can predict the future. And the governor still has all the tools in the toolbox that she needs if they're warranted going into the fall.
We've heard reports of many Michigan businesses, especially in retail and service industry, struggling to fill open positions. I'm thinking of landscaping companies, restaurants, again, storefronts, places where people generally are paid hourly. It's not a story that's unique to Michigan. What's going on?
We are seeing difficulties in nearly every industry. It is not just hourly workers. We're seeing it across the board from professional positions to starting positions and entry-level positions. And employers are definitely responding. We see higher wages and benefits that are being offered than I've ever seen. But I think that there is a transition that is about to occur that will make a big difference, and that is returning the work search requirement for unemployment. That went away about a year ago during the depths of the pandemic. The requirement to actively search for work while you are on unemployment went away. We have been told by the department that will be reinstated yet this month sometime. They said late May, so we're getting to late May now. I think that will make a pretty big difference to have that. You know, it's a safety net. It's an insurance policy. It's meant to help people when they're unemployed. But the end of the bargain traditionally that the employee has to keep is that they have to be available for and searching for work in order to qualify for unemployment help. I think that will make a big difference. But there are other issues too. We know that childcare options have diminished. We know that the way that work has settled into a different rhythm and routine through the pandemic is going to require, I think, some grace and some time to transition back to the expectations that we had before. But as we've seen with the last few months, that the available labor force has shrunk compared to pre-pandemic levels. So even though we see the unemployment level coming down, a big part of that is the fact that there are fewer people in the workforce in the first place. And I think that that's something that we're going to need to turn that trend around to see a full recovery in our state.
How do you do that? I mean, we hear anecdotally that some people who work in hourly wage jobs have had a moment of clarity during the pandemic. Maybe it was personal loss, maybe it was the family situation, or maybe it was just about money or an umpteenth irate customer, you know, who pushed them over the edge in an argument over masking. Who knows? But some economists, you know, agree with you that there might be this cohort not returning. What can we do about that?
Well, I think that there's a lot of different approaches that we have to take. Part of it is education, helping people to upskill and get to a point where they have the types of skills to demand higher wages, make it more worth their while. That's the reason why things like the Reconnect plan and making community college tuition free is an important factor in this. I think we will have to deal with some of the changes in childcare. There are fewer options for childcare and the cost is unaffordable. Part of that is public policy related, but part of it is just the nature of the pandemic. As that industry recovers, then I think that there'll be more options, there'll be more within reach for people to return to work. The state has also launched a tri-share model where employers, employees, and the state all pitch in to help employees under certain income levels afford childcare, high quality childcare. And so there are a lot of different facets to this question about how we get people back to work.
Brian Calley is president of the Small Business Association of Michigan and a former Michigan Lieutenant Governor. Brian, thanks so much.
Thanks, April. Great to be with you.
After the break, why the federal government considers both peninsulas of Michigan international border zones.
We obtained a map from Customs and Border Protection showing that it considers the entire state to be within the 100-mile zone. And so they do this by defining each of the Great Lakes as an international waterway.
We'll explain further in a moment. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As we've discussed this week, Michigan's businesses are navigating some gray areas following the CDC's guidance that vaccinated adults, in most cases, can go about their days indoors and outdoors without a mask. It's yet another crossroads for our neighborhood bars and restaurants, alongside ballooning springtime demand for open tables. We've checked in a couple of times this year with Brian Brickley. He owns the Tap Room in Ypsilanti, where happy hour begins at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Brian, we're so glad to hear you're still open. Welcome back.
Well, thanks, April. It's great to be back. I appreciate it.
We know that the state's restrictions on restaurant capacity are still somewhat limited. How are things going?
So we're doing okay. We're basically at kind of a break-even proposition. So it was great to reopen. And our decision was not to utilize our kitchen. We're just being a great neighborhood bar with beverage service. And that's been great because our regulars can come back, they can hang out, and we're getting, you know, people in.
What was your reaction when the mask mandate was loosened late last week, early this week? Did it change anything about how you're trying to do business at the taproom?
No, it really didn't. It was a shock and a bit of a surprise to see that come forth in the media. And so I waited for a day or two for the health department to reach out, and they finally did. But even their guidance was a little vague. They were challenged as well. They basically said, yes, these things have been released by the CDC, but we still want restaurants to follow the guidelines that were previously issued. So for us, that means the same as it always has. 50% occupancy, masks are required. On our outside seating, if somebody walks directly up to the outside seating without a mask, that's fine with us. But for people coming in, we're still 50% capacity, and we are requiring masks until you're seated.
It feels like the understanding is spreading kind of slowly. Were people coming inside last weekend expecting not to have to wear a mask?
No, not really. And as I've told you before, my wife's really the more the day-to-day operational manager of our place, and I'm more the bookkeeper. But I did make a point to ask her this morning if it was an issue. She said, no, it really hasn't been, and everyone's been cooperating very well. So I think everyone kind of knows that restaurants are kind of caught in the middle, and if there's some patience, our customers have been exhibiting that patience, so we feel fortunate.
There are a lot of restaurants and bars that are having a time finding workers right now. What's it been like for you?
Well, it's next to impossible, to be totally honest with you. So we're fortunate that at our reduced capacity and without a kitchen, we can manage with three or four great longtime employees that we've always had. What we need to get back up to full capacity is 10 to 15 employees. And those are hard to find right now. I do have ads out there. I've gotten a few kitchen staff resumes sent in, but very few servers or bartenders, which, you know, it just kind of baffles me. I don't quite understand that, although I do, because if they're making a decent amount of money staying home and that gives them the ability to, you know, maybe do childcare or something that, that they need to do, I understand. It's a choice a lot of people are going to make.
Your website for the tap room says, come for the drinks, stay for the food. That's so tough that you have to keep the kitchen closed. How much of a problem do you think it is to have the kitchen working at limited capacity right now?
Well, it's not a problem because it's not an option. I was actually fortunate. I felt fortunate that enough people came in just for a few beers and cocktails and to relax to help pay the bills. The kitchen is labor intensive, material intensive. The utilities go up significantly when all the coolers are running and the fryers are running. So it means we lose a lot of business, but it's business I couldn't have handled anyway.
Mm-hmm.
When we get the go-ahead to increase capacity, we'll find a way to open our kitchen and be back. We'll be back so that the website makes sense again.
There's some debate right now about whether the state should require people to apply for jobs if they're receiving unemployment benefits, or if the state's benefits should be reduced to try to encourage people to get back out there in the workforce. What are your thoughts on this? You said you could see the argument for people continuing to stay home if you know, if they have kids in play. Do you have strong feelings about this one way or the other?
I do. I have strong mixed feelings about this. I guess the best way I would phrase this is, you know, we went through a disaster. It's not unlike the southern coast getting hit by a hurricane. When this disaster is more or less over, then we just need to go back to the way unemployment is supposed to work. That it's something to get you between jobs if your job is eliminated. So at some point that smarter minds than me will determine, the disaster is pretty much over or manageable and the unemployment system needs to go back to the way it was. It does not create an incentive for people to go to work right now. And if there wasn't any jobs to go to, that would make more sense. But right now we're on the other side of that coin. There's tons of jobs to go to. And the incentive within the system now is to not even go out and look. So I think soon it needs to go back to the point where people collecting unemployment have to check in, prove they're sending out applications, they're applying and interviewing for jobs. And I think it's, you know, I think it's the way it's supposed to be. And it'll certainly help us, I think, fill these much needed spots.
It's such a funny moment for the service industry. You know, on the one hand, the mask mandates have largely been lifted, not completely. At the same time, it's easy to imagine people who maybe spend a lot of years tending bar waiting tables saying, I can't tell by looking who's vaccinated and who's not. You know, maybe not a risk I'm willing to take. Do you see that changing as we go forward and maybe the vaccination levels possibly go up?
I do. Once again, I kind of see both sides of that coin, too, because there are plenty of people that work for us that have great concerns about that and always have. That's why, as we talked a long time ago, we actually announced we were closing before we had to, because we just didn't want people to get up in the morning and decide if they wanted to get sick just to serve a beer. So, but I think what's helping is that most of our staff are vaccinated. And I think that gives you assurance or more assurance to know that you're safer than you were in the same time 6 months ago when no one was vaccinated. So if our employee is vaccinated, which most of them are, and of course my wife and I are, when a customer comes in, you don't know, but you at least have one level of protection. And if, of course, your customer is vaccinated, you know, I think what the CDC is saying is that you're very, very safe. So that's the new equation that makes it a little more palatable for servers, I think. And the ones that don't want to get vaccinated, I would never force them to do so. That's a call they're going to have to make on their own.
Brian, what can you tell us about what's going on the street? How's the foot traffic in downtown Ypsilanti these days?
It's crazy. I was out there doing the patio a couple weeks ago. I've never seen any more people on the streets of Ypsilanti in my life. And we've been down there 27 years.
Wow.
It's wonderful to see. It's really, really neat. People walking their dogs, people going to other establishments nearby us. It's really encouraging. So it's wonderful.
Well, here's hoping the summer works itself out in terms of the employment situation. Anything else going on with the business that's been of note lately?
We did get a PPP loan. That was helpful. Earlier on, I got a disaster loan. That was helpful. I think the government has given restaurants and small businesses these lifelines that have been extremely helpful. So those things have helped us stay in business. And I'm really optimistic. I see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I hope that light shines come July or August for all of us.
Brian Brickley owns the Tap Room in Ypsilanti. Brian, it's good to hear your voice. Thank you.
All right. We'll see you soon, April. And next time, we're going to talk about something other than the pandemic, like your favorite beer.
Have you ever visited the border towns of Fort Wayne, Indiana, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or perhaps Traverse City? Now, before you get on email to tell me to reexamine my map, we do know those towns are nowhere near the geographic Canadian border. However, U.S. Customs and Border Protection does patrol these areas. Joining us now to explain how this works and how it affects Michiganders is Monica Andrade, attorney with the ACLU of Michigan. Monica, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, April. Thanks so much for having me.
What's going on here? I thought the line between Michigan and Canada was basically through the middle of Lakes Superior, Huron, and Erie. Am I missing something?
Yeah, Avery, you know, I think most people would think that the Border Patrol only operates at the border or in border towns and would be really shocked to find out that they actually live in a border zone. You know, I think a lot of people think that border-related policies really only impact people that live in border towns like El Paso or San Diego. But the reality is that Border Patrol's interior enforcement encroaches deep into and across the U.S. and impacts the majority of Americans. For example, 2/3 of the U.S. population, or approximately 200 million people, fall within this 100-mile zone. And in Michigan, the entire state of Michigan, according to Customs and Border Protection, falls within the 100-mile zone.
So how does Customs and Border Protection define our border with Canada?
So Customs and Border Protection, they claim authority to, under a federal statute, to conduct warrantless searches within a, quote, reasonable distance of the border. And so the federal regulation that interprets that was issued back in 1953 with little deliberation and review. And so at the time, there were fewer than 1,100 Border Patrol agents nationwide, and today there are over 21,000. And so those outdated regulations defined reasonable distance to be 100 air miles from any external boundary. But the regulations also go on to say that the agency is supposed to determine what a reasonable distance is by considering local factors. And the regulation lists some of those factors. But what happens in practice is that the agency uses 100 miles as the default, and they have failed to consider whether 100 air miles is even reasonable. For example, in Detroit, where it's a major city that's next to an international border. And so here in Michigan, we obtained a map from Customs and Border Protection showing that it considers the entire state to be within the 100-mile zone. And so they do this by defining each of the Great Lakes as an international waterway. And so then they assert the right to measure that 100-mile jurisdiction beginning at each lake shore, including Lake Michigan, even though that lake does not share a shoreline with Canada.
What powers does Customs and Border Protection have that they might use in these areas that might be different than local and state law enforcement?
So in the 100-mile zone, Border Patrol can set up checkpoints. They can do roving patrols, which is what most of the report that we just recently released is about. But there is no border zone that is exempt from the Fourth Amendment. I think a few years ago, there was this incorrect statement going around that in the 100-mile zone, Border Patrol had extra constitutional powers, and that's not true. there is absolutely no border zone that is exempt from the Fourth Amendment. So they can do a few other things like checkpoints and roving patrols, but that does not mean that the Fourth Amendment does not apply in that zone.
How might this work out in a place like Traverse City? Do you know of any incidents maybe recently that have happened there?
Yeah, so our report talks about the case of Mr. Arnulfo Gomez. He's a client of one of our coalition partners at the Michigan Immigrants Rights Center. His case is still pending with the Michigan Department of Civil Rights, but what I can share is what he bravely shared for the report. The video of his stop is also available on our website. And so Mr. Gomez was driving in Traverse City, which is 130 something miles from the border, and he was pulled over by Michigan State Police. You know, he handed over his Michigan driver's license, his registration, and his proof of insurance. And he was a legal permanent resident. So what some people say is a green card holder. So he had been here, had been so for over 30 years. And anyone who watches the video can hear MSP saying he's good to go. As soon as he shows his Michigan driver's license, he was told he was being stopped for a loud muffler. But given that Border Patrol was riding along with another Michigan State Police officer, they got called in. And Mr. Gomez, along with his family, had to wait until Border Patrol arrived, didn't know what was going on. Eventually, when the stop ended, no ticket was issued. Mr. Gomez has filed a complaint with the Michigan Department of Civil Rights, like I said, alleging national origin discrimination back in 2018. And so over 2 years later, that complaint remains pending. But the story of Mr. Gomez is not unique. And as the report shows, it's one that happens every day in Michigan.
Monica, as I was reading up on this situation, I learned about something called complexion codes. Can you explain what these are and how they're used?
Yeah, of course. So in the report, we include this complexion code chart that you talk about. So when we were analyzing the data that we got through Michigan Immigrants Rights Center versus the Department of Homeland Security case, the case that all of the data is based from in the report, Border Patrol made it really easy for us to figure out what the extent of their targeting of people of color was. And so the agency uses this complexion code chart to record the skin tone of people in the reports. So for example, they list off albino, black, dark brown, dark, fair, light brown, light, medium, brown, medium, olive, ruddy, sallow, and yellow. But in 96.2% of arrests, people were recorded as being black, dark brown, dark, light brown, medium, or yellow. But tellingly, only 3.7% of those that were arrested had a complexion code recorded as fair or light.
Hmm. So how does that play into possible challenges that might be made in the case of a traffic stop?
So in the case of Mr. Gomez, for example, if an individual is pulled over and they believe that the reason that they were pulled over is simply because of the color of their skin, they can file a complaint similar to what he did with the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. The way that it plays out here in Michigan is that the reason that Border Patrol is able to engage in racial profiling is because our local law enforcement agencies are calling Border Patrol into these traffic stops. So for example, what we learned from the data is that local, state, and county law enforcement agencies are deeply entangled with Border Patrol. And similarly to the racial profiling that we saw with the complexion code chart with Border Patrol, we saw some of those same patterns with our local law enforcement. So for example, 48%, so almost half of the rest of the data that we looked at, it was an arrest that was first initiated by a local law enforcement agency that called Border Patrol. So this could be that they are calling for various reasons, but the two top reasons that were cited were for identification assistance and for translation interpretation assistance. But the data there is also troubling. So for identification assistance, for example, this means that a local law enforcement agency like Michigan State Police, for example, calls Border Patrol for the purpose of reviewing someone's identity documents. But the data showed that 30% of those cases that involved identification assistance, the individual actually presented some valid form of ID, but still somehow Border Patrol was called anyway. And then in translation assistance, of the 26% of arrests that resulted from a Border Patrol agent being called by a local law enforcement agency, not a single case involved people who spoke any language other than Spanish.
So, Monica, what's your takeaway after reviewing this data?
Yeah, I think with the recommendations that we included in the report are pretty important. What we saw from the report after the data analysis is that Border Patrol engages in racial profiling here in the state of Michigan. They're able to do it because they are deeply entangled with our local law enforcement, and they operate in places far from the border. We need to figure out a way to rein in this agency, to rein in Border Patrol, and to commit to a reduction of the number of Border Patrol agents here in Michigan, and to get those outdated regulations that we talked about in the beginning limited so that it keeps Border Patrol out of our communities. For example, the Department of Homeland Security, they really need to hold public meetings to obtain public input on what distance is reasonable. Because ultimately, if a regulation outlines Border Patrol's authority, it really needs to take into consideration the impact that it has on residents that live in border communities like Detroit.
Monica Andrade is an attorney with the ACLU of Michigan. Monica, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, April.
We reached out to U.S. Customs and Border Protection. They sent a statement about some of our questions that reads in part, "It is the policy of U.S. Customs and Border Protection to prohibit the consideration of race or ethnicity in law enforcement, investigation, and screening activities in all but the most exceptional circumstances. As such, CBP is fully committed to the fair, impartial, and respectful treatment of all members of the trade and traveling public." You can read the full statement at michiganradio.org. In a moment, a couple of Michigan filmmakers examine the political life of Hamtramck in a new PBS documentary premiering this month.
There are definitely tensions, you know, as the community changes. There are things that have been taking place over the course of the last 20 years in Hamtramck. A lot of it does have to do with the demographic shifting and the different and unique needs of each community.
More after the break. Stay tuned. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's history is built on the stories of immigrants. But there is no one immigrant story. Maybe no modern city embodies that truth quite like Hamtramck. A haven for Polish Americans for more than 100 years, Hamtramck in recent time has become home to people with roots in India, Bangladesh, Yemen, and elsewhere. Two Southeast Michigan filmmakers, Razi Joffrey and Justin Feltman, are premiering a new documentary called Hamtramck USA next Tuesday as part of the program America Reframed. Razi, Justin, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having us.
Can you tell us a bit about why you decided to focus on Hamtramck?
We were focusing more on the immigration of Hamtramck, and Razi and I met during the 2016 election working on a project around that, and we really kind of looked at Hamtramck and saw a counter narrative that we thought would be very important to tell in the early days of the Trump administration. And so that was kind of our reason why we got involved in Hamtramck and wanted to tell this story. But it's certainly something that once we got there really kind of intrigued us and drew us, especially, you know, again, to Fadl. And, you know, he has his young advisor in the film, Abraham Ayash, who is now a state rep. Their relationship as they are these young guys who are kind of thinking what was worthwhile that the previous generations of political thought in this city took up and carried for us. And what are the things that we really should shift about that?
There are many Michigan communities that have immigrant stories, but you know, Hamtramck does seem different in some ways. What did you two find unique and surprising about modern day Hamtramck?
Well, I think, you know, one of the unique things about Hamtramck is that, you know, it embodies a lot of the current, you know, storylines that we're seeing in the United States across shifting demographics, Islamophobia, some of the anti-immigrant sentiment that pervades large swaths of the United States. And so it, because it embodies a lot of these questions, we're able to tell kind of a story about America through Hamtramck. And in many ways, it is a very unique city, both in its sort of layout and urban planning and design, but of course in its demographics as well, being the first Muslim majority city. However, there are many cities, as you mentioned, across Metro Detroit, many cities and regions. You know, I grew up in Detroit, but then also partly in the Downriver area, which is extremely diverse now and has huge influence influx of immigrants and refugees that have come from all over that have resettled in that area. Of course, you have the northern suburbs of Detroit, Macomb County, Sterling Heights, Warren, Troy, and the western suburbs like Canton, Northville, and Troy, where a huge part of my family lives as well. And so we've seen these massive changes. Another thing we notice in a place like Hamtramck is that there's migration from abroad, refugees being resettled, immigrants coming in, you know, from places like Bangladesh and Yemen. You know, there was the large Bosnian resettlement in the mid-90s during the Balkan Wars. But you also have migration from within the United States, you know, from places like neighborhoods in Queens, Jackson Heights, Astoria. You have several relationships that form between people in Hamtramck and Queens, and you have a lot of people that moved here from there to start businesses or buy properties and things like that. So in some ways, it's a very unique story, but in many ways, this is the story of a lot of cities across the United States as well.
What did you observe happening with people socially in a place where you have a Polish market that sells Bengali food? I mean, do you think that there is a comfort level with difference that we might not find even in other communities that are pretty mixed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Razi kind of hinted at it earlier. Another thing that's unique about Hamtramck is the urban planning. You know, there's not the typical Southeast Michigan single family home, you know, driveway for every home. You're right next door to each other. I mean, Razi, if your neighbors are having a conversation outside, you can hear it through your walls. And, you know, I think that kind of makes getting along have to be, you know, you have no choice but to try to figure a way to go forward. You know, the Polish grandmother, as Razi often says, has no choice but to go to the Bengali market or the Yemeni market and shop for halal meats. And, you know, on something like Punchki Day, everybody's in line to get donuts. Everyone wants a Punchki.
Yeah, not just the Polish,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's gotten, you know, that even a Yemeni bakery will start selling it. Selling punch keys. So it is one of those things that, you know, almost as a default, you kind of have to figure a way to work together, to live together and kind of, you know, at least somewhat get along.
There's a real pragmatism that's fueled by an economic driver, you know, so
it leads to a celebration, but
yeah,
it starts with pragmatism.
Exactly.
I think anybody who's lived in a truly mixed neighborhood can tell you that it's less a static thing and more things that move and often change with time. And as neighborhoods change too. There are some communities of immigrants in Southeast Michigan that have been established long enough that we see generational divides on political and social thought. Did you experience much of that during your filmmaking process in Hamtramck?
Definitely. You know, I mean, I think, you know, there's a perception of Hamtramck that, you know, it's this multicultural utopia, and there's an element of truth to that, because people have to work together to make the city successful and make it functioning. But over the course of its history, you know, there have been different types of tensions between different ethnic groups and also the generations. So one of the unique things about the film is that, you know, we're able to highlight how some of these different generations and ethnic groups actually come together. So you have, you know, Karen, who's over 60 years old at the time, you know, and, you know, all the way ranging to Fadl, you know, who was 23 at the time, you know, Fadl also being an Iraqi immigrant, Karen being, you know, of Polish American heritage. So you see kind of the different, you know, ethnic groups and generations coming together to try to make it work.
We should say Karen is Karen Majewski, who's the mayor of Hamtramck right now.
Majewski.
Sorry, Majewski. Thank you.
Yeah.
My Polish is not what it should be. There's the film spends a lot of time on the political makeup of the city and sort of unpacking what's been happening. Can you tell us a little bit about the power dynamics and the leadership in Hamtramck right now and what's changing?
Sure. I mean, you know, for us, the politics simply sort of framed the storyline. for us. You know, it provided an anchoring, a scaffolding for us to be able to tell the story about Hamtramck. Now, a lot of the visibility for the immigrant community and the Muslim community does take place through the political arena. And it's one of the ways in which these communities find representation, assert their civic duty and their sense of citizenship through the political process. You know, one of the complications in Hamtramck is, like several cities across the state of Michigan, has been under state receivership. So that also throws, you know, to respond to your question, that also throws a little bit of a complication into the power dynamics of the city. And so the mayor is largely a symbolic position. They oversee city council meetings, and they represent the city at conferences and large, like, public events and things like that. Most of the decisions are made by city council. However, during the time of filming, making the documentary, there was a state-appointed regional board that was approving major decisions. So this might be on major water decisions or tax decisions, things like that. So, you know, it does add a complication to how the city manages and runs itself. But I think the symbolism of the different positions for city council, mayor, city clerk, and other elected officials in Hamtramck cannot be understated. For a lot of the, particularly the immigrants, this is a huge achievement in their civic life as American citizens. It's a major, major milestone. So whether those positions carry actual, you know, power or not, to be able to make decisions or not, they certainly have symbolic importance. And they are very, very encouraging for people to not only get involved, but to continue to get involved in these politics. It's a really big deal for them to hold these positions.
If folks are just joining us, my guests today are Razi Jaffrey and Justin Feltman. They're the filmmakers behind Hamtramck USA. It premieres on PBS on May 25th at 8 p.m. Eastern as part of America Reframed. Guys, as we mentioned, the mayor of Hamtramck is Karen Majewski. And she, you know, for all that the role of the mayor is a little different in Hamtramck, she does talk about the fact that she's probably going to be the last Polish-American mayor in a long string of Polish-American mayors in Hamtramck. How does that sit with her? What was her thinking on that?
So I think Karen doesn't lose sleep over it. You know, I think she's very comfortable with the idea that she is going to be the last, or potentially the last, mayor of Polish heritage to be the mayor of Hamtramck. You know, in her education and training, she has a doctorate in cultural anthropology, and so she studies these communities. I think she is somebody that intimately understands these demographic shifts, and as somebody that's lived in Hamtramck and has been involved in Hamtramck politics, and also is a very savvy politician. One of the things that we see with Karen is how successful she is in reaching out to the different communities that call Hamtramck their home. You know, she recognizes it, and it's not really a sort of a statement of defeat. It's just a statement of recognition.
One of the chestnuts of American politics, and I think maybe especially within the Democratic Party, is that there's a certain point at which, you know, identity politics doesn't really matter, that what people want in this country are things like economic opportunity. They want good streets, good schools for their kids, and, you know, probably also health care and just an opportunity for a better life. But there's so many interesting things happening in Hamtramck that kind of push back against that. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the candidate that you followed, Fadl al-Marsoumi. Will you say who he is and why he decided to run for office?
Yeah, Fadl is in the film, he is a recent college grad. He's an immigrant from Iraq. He just was not really involved in politics in college, but I think once he got home, he really kind of felt a desire and need to get involved in the local community, in the community that raised him, really. And so, you know, early on, he kind of talks about how he doesn't really know the rules to running a campaign, but but is really sincere. And I think that's what wins over so many people. He's a Iraqi immigrant, which, you know, the major communities in Hamtramck are more Yemeni and Bangladeshi. So he doesn't really feel like he has a strong community early on, but he really wins people over as a Hamtramckian. You know, he really always kind of leads strongly and passionately with his vision for a better city. And those are those things you're talking about. He talks a lot about education. He talks a lot about road repair, you know, all these not so glamorous things like infrastructure that really speak a lot to local communities.
Yeah. Were there political tension points that you observed as the community changes?
There are definitely tensions, you know, as the community changes. There are things that have been taking place over the course of the last 20 years in Hamtramck. A lot of it does have to do with the demographic shifting and the different and unique needs of each community. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there was an issue with having the noise ordinance changed to allow the call to prayer to take place in Hamtramck, which was ultimately approved by the city council. Getting it approved wasn't an easy task, however. It was, in some ways, an unpopular opinion. But then there were a lot of people that supported it and celebrated something like that as just part of the cultural and religious diversity of Hamtramck's fabric, unique cultural fabric. And so those kind of things will continue to come up. And today, one of the things that we find is that during Labor Day, you have like a Polish float and, you know, a Ukrainian float, and you also have a Yemeni float, and you have representation from the Bangladeshi community as well and other communities. And so slowly, I think, you know, those different communities have gotten integrated very intimately into the broader story that exists. And so I think these are some of the tensions along the way with Hamtramck's history and its democratic process that eventually just change over time. And it's one of the things that I think is very valuable for a story like this to be understood broadly by Americans, because there's a lot to be learned both from Hamtramck's achievements, but also its sort of stumbles along the way with this idea of multiculturalism and diversity.
Were there ways in which some of the newer immigrant communities in Hamtramck, the ways in which their understanding of politics from the countries where they were born or where their parents came from, ways that that's coming to inform the political process in Hamtramck?
Absolutely. That's a really great question. I mean, I think that a lot of people that have come to Hamtramck have, you know, come there from countries that have experienced a great deal of political and economic and social turmoil. Yemen, Iraq, and Syria in the contemporary period, you know, specifically, you know, and so I think, you know, everybody that is getting involved in the political process is doing so because they're intrinsically motivated. This is something that they don't take for granted, because it's not something that they had back home. And while democracy may be a dysfunctional form of government in some ways, it has worked for us in a lot of ways as well. And so a lot of people that come to the United States as new immigrants, particularly from places that experience a lot of political, social, and economic turmoil, are almost coming to it as converts to a new religion. You know,
right.
They don't take it for granted, you know, and they really appreciate it, and they appreciate the stability and the structure that it brings to a society.
Yeah. Can I ask what you saw of COVID during your production process for the film?
Yeah, in my observations, Hamtramck was hit very hard by COVID, as other high poverty, dense, urban populations across the United States were. Both kind of statistically and anecdotally, I can share, you know, different, you know, kind of aspects of that. You know, we lost our state rep, Isaac Robinson, that represented this district, which was, you know, unfortunately, the reason why Abraham was able to, win the seat for state
right.
rep. Abraham was mentored by Isaac, so he's able to call it from there. But yeah, we lost a lot of people, and the community was hit hard. It wasn't something that we were able to incorporate into the film because production was completed before it.
Well, guys, I want to thank you so much for telling us a little bit about the film. Again, we've been talking with Razi Jaffrey and Justin Feltman. They're the filmmakers who made Hamtramck USA. It is premiering as part of the PBS series America Reframed Tuesday, May 25th at 8 o'clock Eastern on local PBS stations. Guys, it's great to talk to you.
April, thank you so much for having us. Really appreciate it.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Paid internships at Michigan Radio are made possible by the Robin Fleming Public Media Internship Endowment. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for being with us. See you next time.